This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four, with you once again, coming to you this time from our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and happy to have you joining us throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM Channel 206, and everyone tuning in worldwide on our website at horseracingradio.net. JT, our first show since returning from Saratoga. It was a busy 7 weeks for us with that Saturdays at Saratoga series, and now we look toward the road to the Breeders' Cup, and we thought it would be appropriate to visit with trainer Tom Morley on tonight's program, considering the success that he had up at Saratoga.
Yeah, what a fantastic meet. Very exciting for him, and it was great to watch, really. I like young guys, new trainers that are showing promise and to have it all come to fruition at Saratoga is really cool.
Well, Tom Morley, not the household name of a Todd Pletcher or a Bill Mott, at least not to this point in his career. But keep in mind, he's only in his fourth year of training, and he's saddled 76 winners so far. He's in the midst of his best year as a trainer, and the native of England can now proudly say that he is a multiple graded stakes winning trainer thanks to Have You Gone Away, the five-year-old mare who won both the Grade 2 Honorable Miss and the Grade 1 Ballerina at Saratoga this past meet. Tom, welcome to the program, my friend.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's a pleasure to be on.
Happy to have you on board and looking forward to hearing your story, but let's start with Saratoga. What a meet.
Yeah, you know, last year I came up here and I thought I had sort of 10 live shots at winning races, and it's Saratoga at the end of the day. You've got to be realistic about these things and realize that, you know, if you think you've got 10 live shots, you've done well if two or three of them win. And we won one by a nose, and I went home with my tail between my legs, and, you know, it probably highlights exactly how difficult it actually is to win up here. But this year has just been... I guess it's to say it's been a dream wouldn't be an understatement. It's just been phenomenal. The horses have stayed healthy. The two-year-olds look like a very solid bunch of horses. And then, obviously, Have You Gone Away? It's been a flagship for us and won two stakes at the meet. And it's been wonderful. I don't really want to go home.
Yeah, I could see that. Well, you know, it seems like in our sport that happens a lot. Like, things are either, you know, dismally bad or excitingly fantastic, and this is one of those meets for you where just everything panned out right. I mean, you, Charlie Baker, Kieran McLaughlin, the three of you guys just really kicked ass and took names at the Saratoga meeting.
It was you know, I have a huge amount of respect for Charlie as well. He's a hell of a horseman, and he's two barns behind me. And so to see him do as well as he did at the meet, as well as us, you know, it was very, you know, we're New York people through and through. So to win in New York and win in Saratoga like we did this year was very gratifying for both of us. And Charlie and I see each other about five times every morning going to and from the track. And there weren't many days where one of us wasn't grinning from ear to ear.
Well, Tom, that win in the Grade 2 Honorable Miss by Have You Gone Away was your first graded stakes victory. We've had so many trainers on this program over the years, and they all tell us that first graded stakes win, first of all, it's so rewarding because it's so difficult to achieve, but then they talk about how special it is. So how special was that day for you?
It was, honestly, and I've said this a few times in different interviews, every time I watch the replay, I get a lump in my throat every time I'm asked to talk about it. You know, I'm 33 years old, and I hope that people realize how hard it is to get to the position of having a horse who's good enough to run in a graded stake. You know, I left school and basically went through 10 years of apprenticeship of earning minimal money and working ridiculous hours as an assistant trainer just to give myself the opportunity to stand in the paddock before a race like the Honourable Miss with a horse who has a legitimate chance of winning it. And so it's not just the chance to win a race like that, but it's a fruition of everything that I've done in my life was to get the chance to do something like that. And it puts a lump in my throat. And I do understand exactly how lucky I am to have that opportunity to have a horse who's good enough, because plenty of people train their whole lives and they never get a chance to win the Honourable Miss. So it meant everything. It literally meant everything.
Yeah, that's a fantastic feeling. And I know what you mean, because you'll read a trainer's obituary, somebody that's relatively famous, and they'll list like maybe one graded stakes or maybe none. And you go, wow, that guy trained, you know, for 40, 50 years. And that's the best he did was win like a listed race. And you just go, wow, that's incredible. So it does give you that lump. And you know, I feel that way when I see people win races, and you get emotional about it if you love the game, like I know you do.
Yeah, I went home that night, and Maggie hadn't come home yet, and I just sat on the end of our bed and just thought about it for 10 minutes and how lucky we are to have the opportunity to train in New York and to have the quality of horses that we're running at Saratoga, and we have a chance to win big races. And yeah, the business is very much in its infancy still, but it's been growing the whole time. I had run a horse in a graded stake before, a few of them. I think probably the best effort had been Noble Cornerstone, got beat 3 lengths in the King Bishop as a 3-year-old. But, you know, if you taste that chance, that opportunity to win a race on a big stage, then there's no better feeling. There is no better feeling than annexing plans. And them coming together like that. It was a very, very special day in my life.
All right, so a few weeks later, Have You Gone Away comes back and wins the Grade 1 Ballerina. What was that feeling like? Compare it to winning the Honorable Miss.
It's a really, really difficult question to answer that, because you dream about that first graded stake win, and yet I've always been somebody who's wanted to go to the very, very top of this industry. And the Honourable Miss is a Grade 2. To win the Ballerina, for 10 minutes after the race, I've had to watch the videotapes again, because I just don't really remember it. It was one of those feelings where the Ballerina is a very special race, to me, not just because I've won it as well, but I've only really been involved. No, that's not really fair, but the best horses I've been around in my life have been filly sprinters. I was with Fleeting Spirit for 3 years in Newmarket. She was a European champion sprinter. I was lucky enough to be with Owen Harvey when he had Dubai Escapade. So I've been around some extremely fast fillies, and the Ballerina is such a wonderfully historical race. Everyone on the face of the earth knows what the Ballerina is. Anyone who's involved in this game, there are plenty of Grade Ones which are, you know, they're Grade Ones, but they're just Grade Ones. The Ballerina's just—it's a little bit special. It's a little bit more special. It's one of those very special races, and so to win it was just—it's very hard to describe, to be honest. It's very, very hard to describe, and it took 2 or 3 days to really sink in that we'd managed to do it.
How about the realization that you're automatically qualified for the Breeders' Cup now in the Filly and Mare Sprint by virtue of that victory?
The Breeders' Cup is they call it the World Championships, and it is the World Championships. You know, it's a congregation of the best horses. I wish it was patronized by the Australians a little bit more, but it's the best horses in Europe and the best horses from America come together. It is the culmination of both racing years, you know, both of European seasons coming to a close and the big racing, you know, it's at a perfect time of the year. So to win and you're in, you know, it doesn't ease the pressure at all, but the fact that she's already a Ballerina winner just means that, you know, we're going to the Breeders' Cup with a legitimate shot as one of the favorites for one of the races there, and that's very, very special in my fourth year as a trainer.
Yeah, it'd be special if you were in your 20th year as a trainer. Those races, the winning your ins, I mean, they're winning you're in for a reason, and the legitimacy of that, having a horse in a race that really fits on Breeders' Cup Day, I mean, that's what everybody's looking for. There's a lot of horses that run in the Breeders' Cup, and they probably don't belong. But, you know, when you win one of those winning your ins, you probably belong because you've beaten some pretty nice horses in the meantime.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm looking at the division now, and the filly of Phil D'Amato's in California, the Calbred. But realistically, to me, I think that probably 90% of the division showed up in the Ballerina. So if you're going to use a race as a form guide to the filly and mare sprint at 7/8 of a mile as well, you've got to think that the Ballerina has to be one of the top races going into it. It's a win and you're in for a reason. As you said, you know, if you win the Ballerina, you're probably not going to be bigger than 5-1 going to the filly and mare sprint. So I like the fact that I've run against a lot of the opposition already, and I like the fact that we've won the Ballerina and we don't have to worry about crossing our route to California now. It's all expenses paid and off we go. So she's just got to stay happy, healthy, and sound, and we're off to Santa Anita.
Tom, does that change your approach with this mare, and maybe in her schedule of races leading up to the Breeders' Cup, now that she already has this win and you're in under her belt?
Well, my initial aim with this filly was to try and get some graded stakes placings. That's what the ownership had requested when they sent her to me. They wanted to try and recoup some of the purchase price and also try and get some graded earnings. Well, she's now a grade one winner, so she's exceeded all of our expectations. You know, initially I thought that the Gallant Bloom back at Belmont was probably our opportunity to win a graded stake with a 6.5 furlongs. She trains absolutely sensationally over the Belmont main track. And so that was always my target for the year with her. I wanted to try and go to Saratoga, and you'll laugh about this, but, you know, we won the Dancing Renee at Belmont, and I thought, well, if ever there's been a real shot of winning a stake at Saratoga, we're going to be 3-5 in the Union Avenue. And so I put her in the Honourable Miss with a view to, if I didn't like the chances of hitting the board, that we'd scratch and we'd run in the New York Red Race 10 days later. And it came up with a lot of speed in it. And I looked at it and thought, well, really, we shouldn't, you know, they're horses. They're fragile animals. If ever there's a chance that she might get some graded earnings, this looks like a real good spot. We ran in that, we won, and then we come back and we win the Ballerina. And now the Callum Bloom has slightly been pushed to the side, purely on timing and the fact that she's already a grade one winner. You know, she has run in 3 stakes in 7.5 weeks. She's won all 3 of them. And so the way I'm looking at it now is I prefer to freshen her up and go with a fresh horse to California than run one more time. I have nominated her to the Gallant Bloom. It's not out of the question that she'd run there, but I'm inclined to train her up to Santa Anita now.
When you're mapping out these schedules for top horses, you have to be able to adjust. And that's what the trainer's real job is to make the proper plan. So if you're following your gut, it looks like you'll just train up to the race.
Yeah, my gut instinct is to she's already back at Belmont. I'm looking forward to seeing her tomorrow morning. It's a track that she trains. You know, the Saratoga main track is a funny surface up there. Some horses love it, some horses don't take to it quite so well. She never actually set foot on the Saratoga main track apart from to run. So I trained her on the Oklahoma and got her back down to Belmont as soon as I could to start our training up for the Breeders' Cup down there. It's a surface that, you know, she trained very well over the Oklahoma surface, but I could see a real, real difference between her on the Oklahoma and on the Belmont main track. So my inclination is to keep her at home. She'll do all her work over the track at Belmont, and then she'll shift to California about a week before the race.
Visiting with trainer Tom Morley on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Tom, a little while ago you mentioned the name Maggie Wolfendale, who people may not realize is your wife. She also works in a capacity with NYRA, where she has to do some analysis before the races and interviews after the races. She had to interview you after those greatest stakes victories. What's it like to be interviewed by your wife after such a special moment?
absolutely terrifying. And I'll tell you why, because she's 7 months pregnant, and both times I was worried that she was going to have our baby. Beyond that, but joking aside, it just makes it all the more special. Maggie is as hardworking a lady as you will ever meet. When she wasn't pregnant, she'd get up, she'd come to the barn every morning, she'd gallop for me six sets every morning, and then goes up and does the paddock analysis in the afternoon. So if ever there was a lady to be by my side who's as entrenched in this industry as I am, then she is the one. And so to stand in that sort of hallowed area at Saratoga, the winner's circle, and be interviewed by my wife, having won the ballerina, was that when I said for 10, 15 minutes after the race, everything just was a blur, it really was. You know, as racing people, it doesn't get any more special than that. It just doesn't.
She's kind of famous. Do you ever take any guff about being Mr. Wolfendale?
So it's taken a grade one win at Saratoga to not be known as Maggie's husband. Hey, Maggie's husband. I've always been Maggie's husband so far. But now, you know, I think I might have just earned the right to be Tom Morley now. I hope, anyway.
Well, you know,
I take plenty of flack about it, definitely.
Her dad, Howard, who, as you obviously well know, a very well-known trainer, has had a lot of success in the game. He was on this program a while back, and I asked him about that. I said, you know, what's it like being Maggie Wolfendale's father? And he said, you know, he said, it's not a bad thing. And it sounds like you're in the same boat, my friend.
No, it is not a bad thing at all. Not at all. You know, she's a highly, highly respected person within our industry. And I'm not saying this because she's my wife, because she was my wife before. And I used to watch the races from here and realize quite how good she is, and she's getting better. She's improving all the time. Her eye for a horse is absolutely staggering. Sometimes I wish that she didn't have to work and she could come to the yearling sales with me. And certainly some of the better horses that I bought at the yearling sales have been out of the Saratoga sale, where she can come and look at them with me, even if it's just one glance to say, yeah, no, I really like that horse, or no, there's something that maybe I've missed. She's a sensational judge of a horse, and a sensational person to be around. She's, you know, it's very, very special for both of us. I guess if she hadn't been crying as much as she was, I might have shed a tear. But one of us had to keep a straight face after winning the ballerina.
Tom Morley here on Trainer Talk. Tom, so what's it like when your horses come to the paddock and Maggie's describing them and talking about this horse looking like a beast and this horse maybe being a little more quiet than she would like to see? What's it like if she doesn't necessarily say that your horse is the star of the show?
Well, she's very diplomatic about it, guys. She very, very rarely actually talks about my horses. Occasionally her hand's forced, where the horse may just look, could be coming back off a layoff or something and look completely different. But she tries not to talk too much about my horses, if possible, and just leave me to it. At the same time, you know, she's also very professional in that she will, you know, if one of my horses doesn't look as good as she was expecting it to, she'll also say that as well. You know, you got to take the rough with the smooth. It's her job. It's her, you know, that's what she's paid to do. She has to be totally objective when it comes to my horses. But if she can get away without talking about them, she will.
A little music in the background,
yeah,
there,
I love,
too.
I love
is
that.
Your dog sitting on the passenger seat again?
Sorry, yeah, my dog just moved to the passenger seat. That means he's got to go. That means he's got to go on a diet. He's a Jack Russell. He shouldn't be so heavy that it's telling him to put his seatbelt on.
My Jack Russell does the same thing. I have to buckle up the belt before he gets in the car, because otherwise it just keeps going off.
So. That is not a bad idea. I'm going to do that right now, so it doesn't disturb.
So, Tom, I mentioned you grew up in England, and that's where this journey started. Take us back to the beginning and tell us about a young Tom Morley first getting introduced to horse racing.
So I come from a English racing family. My uncle David was a grade one winning trainer, trained a lot of horses for Sheikh Hamdan. Henry Daly, who's a grade one winning jumps trainer, is my first cousin. Charlie Gordon Watson, who's a a very, very big bloodstock agent, is also a cousin of mine. So, you know, it's something that's very much in our family, as it were. My uncle Christopher Spence was the senior steward of the Jockey Club in England. So there was always a chance that one of my dad's five sons would end up in the game. And my father's been an owner breeder all his life as well. So on a small scale, but we were very lucky in 1997 that Christopher, my uncle, and my father bred and raced Celeric, who won the Ascot Gold Cup. And so that was a very, very special day in all of our lives. You know, it was trained by my uncle David, owned by another uncle of my father, and a homebred. And to win a Group 1 at Royal Ascot, especially the Gold Cup. I mean, the Gold Cup is the focal point of the whole meet. Yes, there are commercially, there are more important races, but the Ascot Gold Cup is as historic a race as there is in the racing calendar. Where did the love of horses start? It started very much at home. From the age that we were old enough, we were lucky enough to live on a farm in Yorkshire, and mum and dad, my mother's an equestrian through and through and has always had horses. So we had ponies and we went hunting and we went to gymkhanas and pony club, and we were fiercely competitive riders, the three. So I've got two younger full brothers and two older half brothers, but you know, all three of us have ridden all our lives. My next brother Dan Bill is a cavalry officer, so he's in a mounted English army regiment, and Henry, my youngest brother, I will happily sit here and say, is a terrible rider, but absolutely fearless on the back of a horse as well. I hope he listens to this. He'll never forgive me for saying that.
we'll make sure he gets the podcast.
yeah, we're definitely sending that to him. So, ever since we were children, we've had horses around us, and that's how we were born and raised, and it's been a journey. My life has always had horses around it. I guess those summer holiday visits to go and stay with my Uncle David in Newmarket, they were what really sowed the seed of the love of this game in my mind. And I suppose the first horse, Desert Orchid, who was a wonderful jumping horse in England, a grey horse who was absolutely fearless and Four King Georges, I think I'm right in saying, and won the Cheltenham Gold Cup, which was deemed a race you could never win because he wouldn't stay up 3¼ miles. But he was probably the first horse that really stuck in my mind. But the first horse that really made me fall in love with this game totally was a filly called Loxong. And this is another reason why winning the Ballerina was so special to me, because Loxong was an unbelievably fast 2-time European champion sprinter filly, and she was deemed so unsound and so crooked at 2 that she was sent home from the trainer who had her in Newmarket, and she was given to Ian Balding, and she was absolutely lethally fast, and I mean lethally fast. I don't know how many track records she holds in England and in France, but she certainly won 2 Nunthorpes, 2 Abbeys, and the day that sticks in my mind the most was the day at York when I must have been very, very young, because Loxong was running in the early 90s, but I played a bet called the Place Pot, where you have to get, you pick, it's basically like playing a pick 6, but it's the whole card, and you have to pick a horse to finish in the first 3 in each race, and my single of the day was Loxong in the Grade 1 Nunthorpe Stakes, and she clipped her hip coming out of the paddock and bolted to the start with Frank Dettori on her back, and if she finished 5th, and if she'd finished in the first 3, then I'd have been a very, very rich 10-year-old. Just leave it that way. Because the rest of the ticket came in. But there was just something about her that was, she was absolutely magically fast. And so she was the first horse that I truly fell in love with and really got me hook, line, and sinker involved in this game.
Well, you know, you're like so many other trainers we've talked to and so many other people that Jude and I have become associated with in this sport, where they began their careers, whatever they're doing now, they began as a racing fan first and foremost. And it sounds like you've kind of followed that same progression. You started as a fan, now you're working in the industry. Do you still consider yourself a fan of this game, Tom, as opposed to being just a horse trainer and a participant?
So Saratoga, it has to be the most brutal meet for a trainer. And on Monday, I didn't have any runners. And I put on a pair of shorts and a T-shirt, and I went racing. And that was at the end of 7½ weeks, and that should probably answer that question. You know, it's to me, I Maggie and I don't get to do it at all, very often at all, maybe once or twice a year. But if we get the opportunity, we will go racing as fans, yeah.
Yeah, it's the greatest feeling in the world when you get a chance to do that. Did you win?
Did I win? No, I lost. I lost money, but I got to sit in a deck chair and drink a cold beer and enjoy watching horses walk past me without a care in the world. In fact, for two races, I tried to be like my wife and bet on horses that I thought looked well, and I lost a lot of money doing that, so I gave up on that and just tried to enjoy myself. Yeah. Only one of us is good at that.
You don't need to bet to have fun at the races. That's what I tell people all the time. It's a great sport, even if you don't gamble on it. It's still magnificent to watch.
Exactly.
Tom, you threw your brother under the bus. How about yourself? Were you pretty good on the back of a horse?
My wife will tell you that I'm one of the most horrendous riders you've ever seen in your life. So I'm probably not the tidiest. There's quite a lot of me. I'm 6'2" and 200 pounds, so on the back of the horse, I may not be the tidiest person, but I do ride every morning. I have a pony at Belmont. I have a pony at Saratoga. So I'm on the back of my pony every morning. And the rare occasions that I get to go hunting in England, I do still go. I absolutely adore it. And probably that's where I look my tidiest on the back of a horse, is when the horse is big enough and we're crossing grass fields and jumping hedges.
You jump hedges at 200 pounds? Wow, the poor horse.
Hey, they're big horses. They're okay.
Yeah.
Would you say if you could do anything, if you get away from the racetrack for a little bit, that would be the one thing you would want to do?
If I wasn't a trainer and I could do anything in the world, I would live in Africa and I would run a rhino sanctuary. There you go. That's a curveball for you, isn't it?
A rhino sanctuary? Where did the love of rhinos come from?
So the love of rhinos, it's not just the love of rhinos, but they are a horrendously endangered species now. We're almost certainly during my lifetime, if the poaching continues in Africa, there will be no rhinos left. But it's a love of Africa, to be honest. When I was 18 years old, I put a rucksack on my back. I went to Zimbabwe with $1,000 in my pocket, and I spent 7 months hitchhiking through Africa. I taught English in a school for 3 months in Malawi. I went through Zimbabwe, Mozambique into Malawi, traveled up Malawi into Tanzania, then went to Zanzibar, Pemba, Kenya, Uganda, and then I got on an airplane and came home. I took a year out between school and university with a view to just, you know, it's something that we call it a gap year in England, something a lot of people in Europe do. So I went to school in Italy for 4 months and learned to speak Italian and did a history of art course. I went to Africa for 7 months, and then I worked for Ed Dunlop for the remainder of the year, and then I went to school.
We're visiting with trainer Tom Morley here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Fascinating comments there from Tom right before we get to our break. We'll continue this discussion right after this. Stay with us. It is indeed Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. The Fasig Tipton November Sale. The world's premier breeding stock event annually posts the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world. In 2015, broodmares averaged 3 times more than the nearest competitor, and racing and broodmare prospects averaged 5 times more, with weanlings selling for as high as $600,000. The Fasig Tipton November Sale, November 7th in Lexington, Kentucky. Nominate today at FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Since 2000, Millridge has raised or sold 33 Grade 1 winners, including 7 Breeders' Cup winners, 5 Horses of the Year, and a Kentucky Derby winner. Millridge raised foals of 2014 include Oscar Performance and Grade 3 Sanford winner Bitumen. Millridge is offering an outstanding group of yearlings at this year's Keeneland September sale, with 24 yearlings in books 1 and 2, over 90% of those raised or foaled on the farm. Millridge welcomes you to inspect these exciting racing prospects in which you can dream of participating on the biggest stage.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Rossi Maya, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Paula Silver lining on the inside, Karina Mia drifting out through the stretch. And then it's Pie the Moon coming on between those two. And Have You Gone Away, Wavell Avenue is fifth. Here's Have You Gone Away on the outside. And she's coming with a rush. Have You Gone Away and By the Moon on the inside. These two will decide the ballerina. Have You Gone Away has won. Over By the Moon, Karina Mia and Bird at the wire in a final time of 1 minute 21.63 seconds. John Velasquez and Have You Gone Away, a monster race here in the ballerina.
Larry Colmus with the call of that Grade 1 race at Saratoga just a couple of weeks back, and it was Have You Gone Away, trained by our special guest on Trainer Talk tonight, Tom Morley, who picks up the Grade 1 victory over a star-studded field. We're going to continue this visit with Tom coming up in the second half of the program, but do want to welcome everybody back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, Mike Penna, Jude Feld, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. If you did miss any portion of this interview or any of our Trainer Talk shows, simply go back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes to check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. They're all there, horseracingradio.net. Now, remember, next Saturday, that's September 17th, you can watch and wager on the Rico Woodbine Mile live from Woodbine Racetrack. Now, this year's race marks the 35th running of the mile, which will feature another star-stacked international field to take on the world on the E.P. Taylor Turf Course. And one of those stars is champion Teppin. She represents the United States for trainer Mark Cassie. The Queen of the Turf will take on the 2015 winner of the mile, that's Monde Elist. And again, it all comes your way Saturday, September 17th, live from Woodbine. Woodbine will guarantee all of their Triactor, Superfecta, Pick 3, Pick 4 pools. They'll have the 20-cent bet minimums. Make sure you check it out. You can learn more by going to woodbineracetrack.com and using hashtag WOMile on Twitter. Going to be one heck of a day of racing.
Yeah, it's going to be a fantastic day. And of course, everybody's looking forward to seeing Teppin and Monde Elist, winner of the Arlington Million. It's going to be a hell of a matchup.
Tom, do we have a horse for the Woodbine Mile yet?
I wish. Although I have to say, I'm not sure I'd be going anyway. Trying to face off against those two would be a pretty daunting task. They're two wonderful horses, and I've been lucky enough to watch Teppin going working. I mean, my barn is right on the side of the Oklahoma track in Saratoga, and I've been lucky enough to watch her breathing out there. And she is one hell of an animal. She's absolutely electric, a push-button horse, and she's a very, very special individual, very special. I think that probably, you know, occasionally the European the American grass horses get knocked for not being quite the quality of the Europeans, and that's almost always the case. But the fact that this filly went to Royal Ascot, she ran a straight mile for the first time in her whole life on ground that was unsuitably soft, and she still won, is an indication of exactly how good she is, and she is extremely good.
So as we were going to the commercial break, you brought up the fact that you spent a lot of time as a young man in Africa and then went to Italy to study Italian and learn Italian. First of all, why Italian? Why was that the language that you wanted to learn?
Well, I don't speak French fluently, but French is very much part of the education in England. So I already spoke French to a pretty decent level. And it was a pact that all three of us made with our mother, which was that if we gave up languages halfway through our schooling, so at the age of 16, in England, you start specializing in that subject. And mum always said that if we wanted to give up languages at 16, in the year between school and university, that we'd go to a country and live there and learn to speak the language. And well, I'm a pizza lover, so Italy it was for me.
Is the pizza really as good as they say it is?
Oh my God! I live in New York. We are very, very blessed to have good pizza here, but it's a different ball game in Italy.
So, what's Tom Morley's favorite pizza?
Tom Morley's favorite pizza probably has grilled chicken and prosciutto, a little bit of spinach. And you've just got to have good tomato and cheese on there. And I love putting fresh tomatoes on pizza as well.
Sounds delicious. It's almost lunchtime.
Yeah. And we're already talking about pizza.
So you segued from that visit in Italy to working with trainer Ed Dunlop. And as you mentioned, you were about 18 years old at that point. Tell me about working with Ed and where that led and how that got you started with your career.
Everyone has to be given a chance at some point in life and given the opportunity to start their dream, as it were. And Ed was very kind to give me my first shot in racing. I went there, I was very much a pupil assistant. As he said, I walked into the barn and he gave me basically the thought through his mind that this guy won't last 3 weeks. I'd just come back from Africa. I had a very deep suntan. I had blonde streaks in my hair. Basically looked like I'd just come off a beach. So when I finished my time with Ed and I walked into his office to say goodbye to him and have a chat, and he said, I honestly can't believe you turned out like you did, because when you walked in, I thought that you'd be back. Oh, and that was the other thing. Yeah, that was tremendous. I had a pair of cowboy boots that I thought would be appropriate footwear in Newmarket, black leather and white snake skin. Probably not what you should be wearing your first job in racing, but I wore them with pride, and I never took them off. So working with Ed was wonderful. We had some very good fillies while I was there. Mock Schuster and Leilani were there when I was there. And they were just coming to the twilight of their racing careers. And that was, it was cool to be around horses who were winning Irish Oaks and races like that. And it was a great place to start.
Talk about painting a picture. You got a future in radio. That was a fantastic description of yourself. And the first time I met you was at a party at Belmont Park, and I would have never even imagined you looking like that. But that's a great description. And I would imagine there was a little bit of pressure on you since your family was involved when you went to work for Dunlop. You had to kind of back your family name, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, at the end of the day, my uncle Dave was very sadly died in 1998, but he was a big personality in Newmarket, and so you carry the family name behind you, and you hope that you live up to it. And of course, there's a little bit of added pressure, especially when you walk in looking like I did. Ed probably looked at him and was like, "Good God, I need to send this guy home before he embarrasses his family name." But you just hope that you do somebody like you've had an uncle who's worked as hard as he has in this game, and you just hope you do them proud and you do the right thing. And luckily, I think that I hope he's looking down and is pleased with the way it's going anyway.
Tom, what was next after working with Ed Dunlop?
Next was university. My father always said, ever since about the age of 12, I knew I was going to be a trainer. I was determined to train racehorses. My father's always maintained that I should finish my education. Now, there are plenty of people out there who want to be racehorse trainers, and by the age of 30, they don't want to be racehorse trainers anymore. So he was very insistent that I finish my education. So I went back and I finished school. I went to university. I read history at Newcastle. University. I got a BA. I've got a Bachelor of Arts degree in history from Newcastle, and then Dad couldn't push any further. And during my university holidays, you know, I always took holiday jobs with people. I was lucky enough to just spend some time at the Lloyd Webber's stud farm. You'll be familiar with Dare Me and with the Fugue. So one of my first visits, but Maggie and I were at home for my brother's wedding this summer, and I took her back to Walship Down where I prepped yearlings and taken them to the sales. And I'm very lucky to work on a farm as reputable as that, with bloodstock as good as the Lloyd Webbers have. And just tried to broaden my mind before I went down the training route. So Jono Spence, who's also my first cousin, has a very, very prominent sports marketing agency in London, which at the time was doing an awful lot of racing work. He's still very heavily involved in the racing side of it, but he also now, he's broadened his spectrum as well enormously. I spent a summer working for him in London. That taught me two things. Firstly, that I didn't want to work in a city. It's amazing, isn't it? I now train in New York. but the city life, getting on buses and underground, wasn't for me. And also that it really cemented the fact that I didn't want to work in an office, that I wanted to be around the horses themselves. I didn't want to be part of, I didn't want to go into race course management or sponsorship or anything. It was the horses that really did it for me. So, that's how we finished up university and holidays and things like that. And I applied to the Darley Flying Start program out of university, and I was very lucky to get accepted onto that course.
Yeah, that's just an outstanding program, and so many people that graduate from Darley Flying Start, it's aptly named because they just excel, and that's a real feather in your cap.
I always say this to everyone. Anyone who graduates from that program, Sheikh Mohammed, an enormous debt of gratitude. You know, it's entirely sponsored by him. It's 2 years where you're lucky enough to start in Ireland, then move to Newmarket, then you go to Lexington, you go to Australia, and you go to Dubai in 2 years. And you get taught everything from foaling mares to race course management to wagering pools to nutrition of racehorses. And honestly, it's 10 years of experience in two, is the way I describe the program. And so I owe Sheikh Mohammed an enormous, you know, it's difficult to say thank you for an opportunity like that. I'm sure it costs him hundreds of thousands of dollars for every single one of us to go through the program. And I hope that he is proud of seeing the graduates from the course doing what they're doing now. And I believe I was the second graduate trainer to win a grade one. I think Francis Graffard beat me to it in France. I'm sure he did. I know he did, because I remember watching the race. But, I hope that he appreciates that we appreciate what he gave us the chance to do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a very select program, not easy to get into. And I've had the privilege of being able to talk with some of the Darley Flying Start students when they're still in the program and they come to Lexington. And it's always a delight to hear their stories and to hear their backgrounds. And, you know, certainly somebody like yourself, Tom, is benefiting from that program. After you graduated from Flying Start, who was the first trainer to say, okay, I'll take a shot on you, you can come work with me?
So on graduating from the Flying Start, I was lucky enough. Jeremy Nazida was looking for a young assistant as well. Jeremy has a slightly different sort of setup to a lot of normal trainers, in that he has a full-time assistant, Dave Bradley, who is without a doubt the best horseman I've ever been around. And I hope somehow Dave gets to listen to this. I'll have to send him a link. He's a true Yorkshireman, a horseman, and an absolute gentleman as well. But Jeremy was also looking for somebody, a younger person, to give him an opportunity to, you know, study under him. And I went to Newmarket to be his assistant alongside Dave, and spent 3.5 years there. And they were wonderful years, in that I was incredibly lucky to be with Jeremy when his yard was at one of its wonderful peaks. You know, we had Fleeting Spirit there, who was the European champion sprinter, but we also had 60s Icon, who won a Classic. We had Laddie's Poker 2. We landed an enormous gamble in the Wokingham off a 500-day layoff, which is a 30-runner sprint handicap at Royal Ascot. We had Simply Perfect there, who was a multiple Grade 1 winning filly. Soldier's Tale, who came back from two or three near life-ending either injuries or colics to win a Grade 1 at Royal Ascot and beat Takeover Target. So I was there when Jeremy had a barn full of extremely talented horses, and that was wonderful for me to be around and watch a guy who is without a doubt a sensational racehorse trainer train some top quality animals. Was, you know, it was a real privilege and a huge part of my growth to watch Jeremy and Dave develop these horses. Was, you know, it was absolutely priceless time for me.
Yeah, there's nothing like that, being in the presence of great horsemen, and Jeremy is such a fantastic guy on top of it. It just had to be incredible.
Yeah, it was wonderful, you know, and he was the one who really opened my eyes to America again. I'd spent some time with Owen Harty in his barn at Belmont when I was on the Flying Start. A big part of the program is that you get not farmed out, but you get placed with people within the sphere that you want to go into. So while I was on the program, I was lucky enough to spend 6 weeks with Owen at Belmont and then spend 6 weeks with Gay Waterhouse in Sydney. And, you know, I view those as very, very important parts of my learning curve. But Jeremy, as we all know in America, is not afraid to bring a horse over here and target a big race. And, you know, we won the Gotham with a horse who I was very heavily involved in the training of, Awesome Act. He obviously won the Breeders' Cup with Wilco, beating Smarty Jones. We won back-to-back runnings of the Jamaica. Jeremy's not averse to bringing horses out here. He bought Nemorelia out last year. She stayed in my barn for the whole time she was out here. You know, it's kind of neat whenever he sends a horse to run in New York. Jeremy's very good. He sends the horse to my barn because he knows that he's had somebody who's worked for him for 3.5 years is going to be looking after the horse.
Tom Morley, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on HRRN. Tom, well, it sounds like you really had things rolling in your native England. Why make the move to the United States? What brought you to America?
It's something that a lot of trainers in England and Ireland have done, is spend some time out here. Brian Meehan spent a good amount of time in North America. Jeremy obviously trained in California himself. And John Gosden's also somebody who's used that route of you know, spending time in America and then going home. And the plan was always to do that. And Eddie Keneally was very, very kind. He was, you know, he took a bit of a shot at taking me on. But while I was there, I was very lucky to spend, you know, Brendan Walsh and I were the two assistants for Eddie. And I hope Eddie thinks that we've gone on and done him proud as well, because, you know, it's very important that the guys who teach you, I hope we do them proud. But so I came out here and I went to Florida, to Palm Meadows to Eddie, and then to Keeneland, then to Churchill, and then to Saratoga. And then Eddie was just getting, you know, he had a lot of horses, but he picked up a couple of big New York owners in Joe Bushi and Anstu Farm, and was going to have an operation here year-round. And he asked me if I'd be interested in staying in New York and being his assistant in New York. And as they say, the rest is history. You know, I fell in love with New York. I fell in love with the level of competition here, the standard of horsemen, the fact that, in my opinion, you know, these are they're the best horses in America. It's the toughest racing circuit to be on. And then I met my wife, and I've always been one to challenge myself, and it just seemed like an awesome challenge. The idea of starting in New York just really appealed to me, and obviously Maggie was here as well, so we set up camp here.
Cue the Sinatra song.
Yeah, not being a city guy, how have you adjusted to life in the big city with New York?
I'm a country boy through and through, but we have a wonderful little home. Maggie's a country person as well, and have I adjusted? No. Do we go to New York very often, to the city? Not as often as you think. Probably once a month we might go to Manhattan. And it's, you know, how have I adjusted to it? I love going to Saratoga. It's a breath of fresh air to get out into the countryside, but I'm very happy on Long Island, and I'll always, even if the future brings a move, I'll always maintain a stable at Belmont, because I love Saratoga, and I love what's just happened there. But I tell you, when I run my first horse on Friday back at Belmont, I'll sit in the boxes there, and that's home. That is, you know, to me, Belmont, I've never been to Santa Anita. Hopefully I'm lucky enough to go this fall, but to me, Belmont is the pinnacle. It's the, you know, it's the big daddy, as it were, of racetracks in North America, both actually physically and, you know, I love winning there. I love winning at Belmont.
Tom Morley here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Tom, Eddie Keneally, who you mentioned is one of your mentors when you came to the United States, Eddie was based at Saratoga for almost the entire meet as well. So after you won those two greatest stakes, and in particular the Ballerina, did you have a chance to run into Eddie and talk with him afterwards, or did he make it a point to come to you?
Yeah, I don't just call Eddie a mentor and an old boss, but he and his wife, Catherine, and their children, they're very close friends of ours as well. Eddie's a wonderful guy to work for in the barn. It's all business, but then, you know, if he's having a barbecue in the evening, you're the first people on the invite list are his assistants. So it's very much a family operation. His wife Catherine's a wonderful lady who's been so kind to Maggie and I, and so, you know, that you live off each other's success. I mean, Eddie obviously won the greatest stake with Bitumen at the beginning of the meet, and that was that. You know, that gets us all fired up. And then, but he's always, you know, he's always winding me up. If I ever beat him in a race, he sends me a text going, "You're becoming a big time trainer now," and this, that, and the other. And you know, it's fun. We ride off each other's coattails like that.
What's the biggest difference you see with trainers and the training style in America as opposed to over in England?
There's a huge difference. A lot of the training, obviously all the training in North America happens on the track, unless you're lucky enough to train at somewhere like Fair Hill. So it's all track training, and it's on dirt here, unless, you know, we're lucky enough in Saratoga to have the Oklahoma turf track that we can train on, but it's basically all left-handed oval training. In Europe, we're incredibly lucky to have amazing expanses of grassland to train horses on, with some of the oldest turf in the world that's been maintained for hundreds of years purely for the use of training horses on. That's it. You know, a lot of the training is done up hills at home. I think probably to say our horses are fitter wouldn't be an accurate description, but they're certainly a different build of horse as well, the European horses. They're a lighter frame, you know, and they lend themselves to that type of training. And obviously, you know, a lot of our racing is over further distances than it is here. So there's more emphasis on speed here. There's more emphasis on speed from the gate here, because that's the way our races are run. That's the way dirt racing, you know, the fastest quarter of a dirt race is the first quarter of the race. The fastest quarter of a grass race is almost certainly the final bell. Normally, tailor your training to that. And obviously the chance to use expanses like the race course at Newmarket and the lime kilns is, you know, it's a completely different approach to training a horse.
You obviously have vast experience in training England and the United States. What do you miss the most about training in Europe?
I think I miss the variety the most, guys, because you know, it's something that we lack a little bit of here, and it's through no fault of anyone's, you know, but most of our racetracks here are in metropolitan areas, and they're used for long meets. But certainly in Europe, you know, you might have a horse who's better going left-handed than he is going right, and he wants good to firm ground, not good to soft ground. And so it's finding the race on the day where the sun shines and the track's left-handed and the ground's good to firm and everything falls into place, and that's the day that the horse should win. Here it's you know, we're based in one place for longer, and we race there for months on end, whereas at home, meets tend to be 2 to 3 days long, and then we're off to somewhere else. And I also, I guess, I mean, Saratoga, it's very difficult to say I miss the fans when I'm driving home from Saratoga, because New York has the best fans on earth for Saratoga. But, you know, our racetracks here, Keeneland do a tremendous job of getting good crowds in there, and Gulfstream are doing a wonderful job as well. But we lack fans at the track here, and I miss that. You can go to a small track in England, and the place is packed on a Thursday afternoon, and you're wondering why people aren't at work. But at the same time, you're not wondering it either. It's wonderful that, you know, the attendance base at home is tremendous.
Well, Tom, we've really enjoyed the visit. It's hard to believe that the hour is already up, but it certainly is, and we appreciate you taking the time. Like all of our guests who appear on Trainer Talk, you're going to receive a gift from one of our sponsors. That's Flair Equine Nasal Strips, so we will get those out to you. And, again, can't thank you enough for your time. Very quickly, though, before we do wrap things up, want to ask you, you mentioned your wife, Maggie Wolfendale, 7 months pregnant. You would never know it to look at her. Do you have a name picked out for the baby yet?
We do not know what we're having. We're having a surprise, which is, you know, as we just discussed, there aren't many surprises left in life with modern technology now, so it's going to be a surprise. So I'm going to leave the name for it as a surprise for you as well.
All right, well, all the best. We can't wait for the new addition, maybe the new horse trainer or jockey to come into this world.
Yeah, I'd say it hasn't got much of a chance. It's probably. I hope it likes horses.
Well, Laz Pereira always told me when you have a kid, you go on a hot streak. So it looks like yours has already started. Just keep it on going.
Well, everyone says that, yeah. So hopefully it keeps going.
Well, Tom, we appreciate the visit, my friend. Thanks so much. Continued success, and we'll look forward to catching up with you soon.
Thank you for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it.
All right, that's trainer Tom Morley here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Don't forget, if you did miss any portion of that show, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. The podcast available for you to listen to at your leisure, and you can take it with you wherever you go, on your computer, your smartphone, tablet, mobile device, whatever it might be. Bluetooth it in your car. Why not?
We did.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. We listened to the whole Jock Talk with Calvin Burrell and Christina McManigal coming back from Saratoga.
Yeah, that was really cool. It was
a really entertaining show. Right?
Very entertaining. Great. It was a great job. Christina really did a great job with Calvin, and Calvin was very forthcoming and really seemed to enjoy himself.
And that show is also posted on our website. Check out all of our Trainer Talk shows, Jock Talk programs, Express Bet Weekend Stake Preview shows. They're all there. Our Brisnet call-in shows, they're all there for you to listen to. And, of course, you can tune in live, Sirius 219, XM 206, and that entire schedule on our website, horseracingradio.net.
Yeah, what do we got coming up this weekend?
Going to be a busy weekend, my friend. Not as busy as it has been the past 7 weeks, though. We're kind of on a bit of a downhill slide here for a couple of weeks, trying to recuperate from the 7 weeks in Saratoga. But a busy Equine Forum show, 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern. You can catch that every single Saturday, Sirius XM 93, and streaming worldwide on our website. And, of course, a few terrestrial affiliates around the country on board for that program, too.
Yeah, and, of course, Fasic Tipton, the sponsor of this program, great sales up there.
Unbelievable sales.
Yeah.
As always.
Yeah. And the New York breds. Huge purses.
Tom Morley talking about buying horses at that Fasic Tipton sale. That's where he goes to get his big greatest stakes winners. And we'd encourage everybody to head out to the Fasic Tipton sales and do the same.
Absolutely. It's a great spot.
All right. Well, it's been a lot of fun here tonight. Our thanks to our special guest, Tom Morley. Our thanks to our producer, Lee Delapina, doing a great job here in studio with us. For Jude Feld, I'm Mike Pena. We will talk to you next time right here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.